Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These eight lectures are titled Business Law, Torts. The lecturer is Professor Frank Cross of the College and Graduate School of Business at the University of Texas at Austin. Frank Cross received his BA from the University of Kansas in 1977 and his JD from Harvard Law School in 1980. After graduation, he practiced law with the Washington, D.C. law firm of Kirkland & Ellis before his appointment at the University of Texas. While at the University of Texas, Professor Cross has taught undergraduate classes, MBA classes, and executive education courses in aspects of the legal environment of business. He has received numerous teaching awards, including departmental awards, MBA teaching awards, College of Business Administration awards, and one university-wide teaching award. Professor Cross also was honored 4 years ago as the nation's outstanding professor by the Academy of Legal Studies in Business and was recognized as a top teacher by the Business Week Guide to MBA Programs. Professor Cross has authored numerous publications, including over 30 articles in journals of law, science, policy, and management. He has also published 4 textbooks for business law classes and several other academic books. Professor Cross serves on the editorial boards of 4 journals, including the American Business Journal. Lecture 1, Foundations of Torts and Negligence, Introduction.
Greetings. Today we're going to start talking about tort law. Tort is as important an area of law as any. It's where much of the liability that individuals and business confront comes from. So what is the nature of tort law? Where does tort law come from? First, what does tort mean? Well, tort is a French word that means wrong or pastry. We're going to be using it in the first sense of wrong. And tort law is known as a civil wrong. This is the law that is built up over the decades and centuries, again starting in England, where we decided that certain types of actions were simply wrong, even if they were not prohibited by law, and that if these types of actions caused injury or harm to someone else, you should have to pay that person. So, tort includes things like assault and battery. You probably have some idea of what those are. Tort includes things like negligence, careless driving. Tort includes a lot of things, and we'll go through a lot of them in the next few lectures. Now, you're probably aware that there's a big controversy in the United States right now over the high cost of tort litigation. The theory is that business is being crippled, driven into bankruptcy by too many Americans suing, too many people suing for everything. Well, that's not entirely true. In fact, most Americans who are injured, even injured by the fault of someone else, don't sue. But there are enough people out there who do that you've got to be careful. You don't want to go around committing torts, or you're going to get hit with a lot of liability. So how do you avoid that? First, we're going to start with the foundations of tort law, where tort comes from, what it's talking about. Now, the evolution of tort law includes 2 key concepts, a duty, which is breached, and a legally protected interest. So for you to be liable for a tort, you must first have breached a duty. Well, what sort of a duty? Where did this duty come from? Well, that's not always well defined, which we'll go into. But you're only liable if you're subject to some duty that you failed. Now, all of us are given a duty of behaving like the reasonable person. It used to be a reasonable man, now it's a reasonable person. All of us have to behave like a reasonable person as we go through our lives. And if we behave unreasonably and hurt someone, we've breached that duty to be a reasonable person. But the duties are better defined in some areas. Some people have higher duties. Clearly, a doctor has a higher duty of care than an ordinary person who's trying to resuscitate you. Other cases, there are no duties. There generally is no duty to rescue people unless you produce the situation which required the rescue. We'll talk about specific duties later, but know that you're not liable in tort law unless you have breached some duty. The second concept key to tort law is that of the legally protected interest. That of the legally protected interest. Even if you breach a duty, you're only liable if you have violated someone's legally protected interest. Well, what are legally protected interests? Well, many of the legally protected interests are the one you might assume, physical well-being. If you breach a duty and you hurt me, you take my hand off or something, you've violated a legally protected interest. But not all harms are legally protected interests. And some of the greatest harms are not legally protected interests. What if someone behaves terribly thoughtlessly toward you and causes you a broken heart? Well, your broken heart might hurt more than a broken finger. But you can sue for the broken finger. You can't sue for the broken heart. The law doesn't want to get into that. You can't sue someone for negligently failing to return your phone calls. You can't even sue them for intentionally failing to return your phone calls. Hurt feelings, as a rule, are not a legally protected interest that the law is concerned with. Maybe it should be. Maybe this shows the paternalism of the law. I don't know. But it's not. It's not a legally protected interest. So don't try suing somebody for a broken heart. Likewise, you can't sue somebody for a variety of forms of you know, emotional distress you might suffer. I mean, suppose you sit down in a class and you're sitting straight across the room from someone and this person is really awful looking to you. You know, you think this person is so ugly. And you have to look at them every day because you have this assigned seat in class. You have to sit there every day and you have to look at that person every day. And you can't bear it. And you have nightmares. Ah, this person is so appalling. This person is so ugly. I can't take it. Can you sue that person for that? No, you can't. Can't sue somebody for just looking the way they look, even if that causes you great emotional harm. Now, if they were shooting spitballs at you, that would be another matter. But, okay, that's the basics of tort. Breach of duty and a legally protected interest. Now, I want to talk about the categories of tort as we go into more background about tort law. There are three main categories of torts, and they evolved in pretty much this order. First, the intentional torts. Second, torts of negligence. And third, some cases where there is strict liability, which means you're automatically liable for the harm you cause, even if you haven't breached a duty, really. Let's start with intentional. Intentional torts are where you take an action on purpose and cause harm to another person, thereby injuring them. An action taken on purpose. And there's an old phrase here that even a dog knows the difference between being kicked and being tripped over. Well, that's the difference between an intentional tort being kicked and an unintentional tort being tripped over. Now, you think intent might be an easy matter, whether someone did it intentionally or not. But it's not always easy because sometimes someone didn't necessarily intend the consequences. Suppose I come into my classroom. One student's giving me a particularly tough time. I pull a gun out of the drawer, point it at that student, and shoot him. Is that an intentional tort? Sure it is. I intended to shoot him, I shot him. But what about if it's not one student who's giving me a particularly hard time? What if the whole class is giving me a hard time? I'm upset, I pull a gun out of the drawer, I close my eyes, and I start shooting randomly around the room. And I hit someone. Is that an intentional tort? You say, well, I didn't intend to hit that person. In fact, that was my favorite student. That's the one person I didn't want to hit. So does that make, is it still an intentional tort? Sure it is. I made an intentional act. The shooting the gun with my eyes closed was intentional. And the consequences of hitting this person were reasonably foreseeable. So sure, that's an intentional tort. Okay, let's take it one step further. Suppose that I come into the classroom late at night at 2 a.m. after I'm through with all my hard work, and I sit there and I squint and I imagine all the students sitting out there in their assigned seats, and for my sort of vicarious violent pleasure. I start, you know, picturing people sitting there and shooting them, you know, without them actually being there, and so I think this way I'm safe. But it so happens that one of the students has been kicked out of his apartment and has taken up residence and is sleeping under the desk, and a ricocheting bullet hits him. Is that an intentional tort? Probably not. I mean, I probably will owe him, but not an intentional tort, because I did an intentional act, that is, I shot, but in a seemingly empty room. It was not foreseeable that someone would have taken up residence under my desk. Okay, so this is one point of law. A rule of law is that intent follows the bullet, as a general rule. Intent follows the bullet. So in the old Dallas show, if somebody, you know, means to shoot JR through the back of a big chair like this and accidentally hits Bobby, who's their best friend, it couldn't have been an intentional tort. Bobby Ewing's my best friend. Well, it is an intentional tort because you intended to shoot the person sitting in the chair. You were simply mistaken about that person's identity. Well, what are intentional torts? Well, the best known intentional torts are assault and battery. Now, assault and battery are generally, they go together like a salt and a pepper, but they are different, okay? Assault is putting someone in fear of harm. Battery is actually causing them harm. So, if I hit you over the head with a 2x4, that's a battery. If I come at you from the front with that 2x4, so you see me coming and have reason to fear I'm going to hit you, that's assault. But if I snuck up behind you with a 2x4 and hit you in the back of the head, that's a battery without an assault. You never saw me coming. You never had any fear. You simply felt the battery of my club. And of course, you can also have an assault without a battery. If I pull out a gun and point it at you and say, I'm going to shoot you, and then I don't, there's no battery. I never hit you. But you were assaulted. You had reason to fear that I would shoot you, so that you suffered some harm there. And that's mental distress, and that's the kind of mental distress the law does compensate. Once again, not broken hearts, but fear of people pointing guns at you. That's something that the law will take the time to compensate. Assault and battery. Another intentional tort there are a lot of fun intentional torts. We'll talk about some of them later. But another one that's sometimes relevant is called false imprisonment. False imprisonment. This is where you restrict someone's freedom of action. False imprisonment could be from putting handcuffs on them. False imprisonment could be from locking this door so we can't get out of the room. That's false imprisonment. That comes up for a lot of businesses, if you think about it. Because you believe you own a business, and you think someone's shoplifting, right? So, what do? You stop them. You question them. They want to go. You don't let them leave. You wait for the police to come, or you take them to the back room and question them until you're satisfied, right? Well, if they were not, I mean, you cannot be perfectly sure you got the right person. So, if it happened that they were not shoplifting, they ordinarily would have a very good false imprisonment case against you. You restricted their movement for a time. Most states have passed what are called anti-shoplifting laws that protect business owners from this sort of false imprisonment claim. These anti-shoplifting laws permit you to restrain someone, to imprison someone, if you will, if you do it in a reasonable manner for a reasonable time and you have reason to believe that this person was the shoplifter. Now, you've got to meet all of those requirements. I mean, there are some cases where businesses were abusive and took people in the back room and put them under a bright light and questioned them for 6 hours over, you know, the theft of a loaf of bread, which they hadn't even stolen in the first place, and they had a receipt for it. And in those cases, you're still liable for false imprisonment. But if one is careful about the reasonable time, manner, and belief, you can restrain a shoplifter without concern for false imprisonment. Oh, what's another interesting false imprisonment case, I think, is a fellow had not paid his parking tickets or was parked illegally, and a tow truck came to tow his car away, and he would not leave the car. He refused to leave the car. So that tow truck said, well, what the heck? They cranked him up, and they towed the car with him in it. Guess what? That was held to be false imprisonment. That was held to be false imprisonment because they restrained his freedom, because it was considered that once it was, you know, on the tow truck, he wasn't really able to get out of the car, even though he might want. So that's another intentional tort. as I say, we'll talk about some more, particularly some that are likely to get business in trouble. But that's a background for intentional torts. The second category of torts are the torts of negligence. Negligence is where you commit a tort, you hurt someone out of your carelessness or your stupidity or your, maybe perfectly smart, your failure to think. Now, negligence torts are many of the classic ones you know about. If you're in an automobile accident, you will probably sue or want to sue or claim that the other person was negligent in order to recover from their insurance. You'll say they were driving negligently. What does driving negligently mean? Well, driving negligently means any form of driving that is not safe in the way that a reasonable person would behave safely. So speeding would be driving negligently. Driving a car without brakes would be driving negligently. Driving a car while looking at the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue would be driving negligently. Any sort of thing that would be an unsafe driving or other actions in your life, doesn't have to be driving, are negligent. If you hurt someone, particularly if you hurt someone physically, that's a tort. Now, the third category of torts is strict liability. Strict liability are torts where you have to pay someone for causing harm, even if you did nothing wrong. Even if you, you know, dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's and behaved perfectly, arguably you breached no duty, but you're still liable in strict liability. It doesn't apply very often. When does strict liability apply? Strict liability applies to what are called ultra-hazardous activities or substances. So if you are in the explosives game, you blow up buildings and blow holes for roads and things like that, you may be perfect at it. You may be great at it. But the theory is this is so hazardous that even if you take every precaution known to man, you might still injure someone. And if you take every precaution known and you still injure someone, you're still liable. That's what strict liability means. Even if you are careful, you're still liable. Strict liability. Another example of strict liability is this is not a tort so much, but under the federal law of Superfund. If you deposit hazardous waste on the ground, or if you own land where they are, you're strictly liable for the cost of cleaning up those wastes, even if you've done nothing wrong, even if you've behaved like a perfect little angel. Another example where you find some strict liability is for products. If a product is sold and it hurts you, specifically if it hurts you physically, the product manufacturer will be strictly liable, even if they did everything right, nothing wrong at all. So those are the three main categories of torts. The first one we're going to start in with is negligence, because negligence is the number one tort, the big one, the one that is most often alleged and that most often produces damages. So in negligence, we're going to start with the concept of breach of duty. Breach of duty. When have you breached a duty that would subject you to liability in negligence? And the first thing we're going to talk about here are the general duties. General duties of the reasonable person. I talked about this a little bit already. How does the reasonable person behave? Well, the law doesn't have a clear-cut determination of how the reasonable person behaves, but we know some things about the reasonable person. The reasonable person is clearly a bit of a nerd. The reasonable person is very cautious. The reasonable person never breaks the law. The reasonable person also always looks ahead at the possible consequences of his or her acts. So, you have to behave like a reasonable person when you're driving your car. And a reasonable person driving the car is probably better than the average driver out there. The average driver out there probably is not always behaving like a reasonable person. A reasonable person is also always reasonable when they're walking, or when they're sitting at a desk, or when they're playing sports. They're always looking ahead. You know, they're playing football. They may tackle you, but they think about how they're going to tackle you. You know, they don't tackle you in an unnecessarily violent way that might hurt you too much. Okay, well, does the concept of reasonable person vary by the person? In other words, can I say, well, I'm really dumb, so I should be held to a lower standard? Generally, no. An exception always is made for children. A child does not have to operate by the same reasonable person standard that an adult would. a child is held to a standard that would be reasonable for someone of this age. So you don't hold necessarily a child to the same high standard. What about adults that suffer some incapacity? Well, they're still held to a reasonable person standard that's pretty strict, but their reasonable person standard is a little different. It's a reasonable person in their circumstances. Suppose a person is blind and they go out and jump in their car and drive. Well, for an ordinary sighted person, jumping in the car and driving would not be an unreasonable act, right? That wouldn't be negligent for you to just jump in your car and drive. But for a blind person to jump in the car and pull out into a crowded highway, that's probably an unreasonable act right there. So that would be negligent, given their specific circumstances. So the specific circumstances are taken into account in this general, all-purpose, reasonable person standard. Okay, now I want to talk about specific duties, however, because in addition to the general reasonable person duties, specific duties can arise in a lot of circumstances. One specific duty arises out of special relationships. Special relationships impose higher duties on those people in those special relationships and may indeed create a duty to act. What's an example of such a special relationship? Well, the doctor-patient relationship, of course. A doctor-patient relationship imposes special duties on the doctors. The doctor has greater responsibilities than that of the reasonable person. You know, someone's cutting you open with a surgical knife, and he has greater duties than the average person who might take a surgical knife to you. So those special duties, special relationships, may create a stronger, a greater, more specific duty. And malpractice, I mean, that's the word people throw around, malpractice is really negligence by doctors. It's called malpractice. And lawyers also can, and I assure you do, commit malpractice, as do other professions. Accountants may commit malpractice. This is just a form of negligence that's specific to their profession, where they have a higher standard that they must meet. Second specific duty is legal responsibilities. Failure to conform to legal duties is a breach of duty automatically. Thus, if you break the law, you are negligent. If you're out there driving and you're speeding and you get into an accident, now why are you speeding? That's so irresponsible. Well, you were probably speeding because, oh, the other traffic seemed to be moving pretty fast and you were in a hurry, and frankly, these speed limits are a little low, and you think you're a perfectly safe driver when you're going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit. And for all I know, you are. Maybe you are a perfectly safe driver when you're going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit. But that's not going to be a defense in a negligence action. You were negligent for going 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit. And the law doesn't want to hear you say, oh, I'm a really good driver. I can go 5 or 10 miles over the speed limit safely. Even if you're a race car driver, they don't want to hear it. If you drove over the speed limit, you violated your legal responsibility, and you are negligent. Now, there are some exceptions to this, because you can get into some technicalities. For example, people have failed to get their license plates renewed. They failed to get their license plates renewed on time. Then they got into an accident. And they broke the law, right? Their license plates were not renewed. So are they negligent and therefore responsible for the accident? Well, not necessarily. There has to be some connection between the law that was broken and the people who were hurt in the accident. On the other hand, if you failed to get your car inspected and an accident resulted, that might be, this is called per se negligence, automatic negligence for breaking the law. That might be per se negligence. Your driver's license, which of course requires you to take an eye test and perhaps some other form of tests, that is relevant to driving safety. So if you don't have an active driver's license, that might well be considered per se negligence. You'd be responsible for that accident. I'm not so sure that would necessarily be the case with expired license plates, which is basically just a fundraising measure for local government. Isn't designed so much for safety. Okay, a third specific duty may arise out of custom. The general custom will create certain duties upon you, particularly in business. A practice or custom will create a duty to behave in a certain way to conform to that custom. Now, custom is not so dispositive as legal responsibilities. In other words, just because you're abiding by a custom doesn't necessarily mean that you're abiding, you're behaving properly, like a reasonable person would do. If it is customary in your neighborhood to have drag races on the streets at 8 p.m. every Friday night where people go 150 miles an hour, you may be abiding by custom there, but that doesn't mean that you are a reasonable person. And it doesn't mean that you're not liable if your drag car racing car gets into an accident. Likewise, if you're driving the streets at Thursday night and you're not going 150 miles an hour, you're only going 30 miles an hour, that does not mean that you're negligent as a consequence. So custom is a factor we consider, but it is not conclusive. Okay. Next issue is an interesting one that always troubles people, particularly foreigners, and that is, do you have a duty to act? Does the reasonable person have a duty to take an affirmative act to help someone, to rescue someone? Well, this is America, so heck no. Everybody's supposed to look out for themselves in this country, right? So the reasonable person doesn't have a duty to act, and we have carried this to extreme in our law. You're walking down the street. There's a little ditch by the side of the street. In the ditch, you see a child, an infant, face down, drowning. Now, you could rescue that child without any hazard to yourself. I mean, the water is only a few inches deep in this ditch. But what if you don't? What if you're a gruff, old, curmudgeonly type who thinks that, well, if children don't learn to protect themselves now, they never will? And so you walk on by, and the child dies and drowns because you did not take the trouble to go three steps out of your way to pick up this child out of the water. Well, that seems pretty appalling, and it's certainly tragic, but the general rule in the law is you have breached no duty. You've got no duty to rescue, so you've breached no duty, unless you are the one who dumped the child in the water, then you might have such a duty. But you've breached no duty to rescue. You're not liable. That's the general rule, and it still holds pretty much true to this day. There are some exceptions, however. Various states have passed laws. These are not torts. This is not common law made by judges. But state legislatures have passed laws that impose some requirement on you to stop and render assistance if you see people in trouble. Those laws, incidentally, tend to be pretty weak. Their definition of render assistance usually consists of driving to the nearest phone booth and reporting it, not necessarily doing anything yourself. But some state laws have modified this duty to act a bit, and therefore given you a greater duty to act or rescue. And there is a case where the common law actually found a duty to rescue that I guess is sort of an interesting one. This involved a bar. There were two people in the bar. Well, there are a lot of people in the bar, but two people are of interest to us because one rushed in and said he was going to kill the other one. And the other one said, no, kill me, and pleaded for mercy, and they were fighting and arguing and all this. And a good Samaritan-type patron at the bar ran next door to the bar next door and said, somebody's about to be shot, we've got to get the police, let me use your phone. And the bartender at this second bar said, look at the sign, Mac. The sign said, phone not for use of customers. He said, you don't understand, somebody's going to be killed, we've got to get the police, you've got to let me call, we've got to do something about it. And the bartender said, this is America, not my business, not my trouble. So he didn't let him use the phone. And after some time, you know, enough time that the police might have been able to get there, the fellow at the bar next door was shot. So the survivors of the person who was shot sued the bar where the fellow wouldn't let him use the telephone. Now, under the traditional rule, his action in refusing to let him use the telephone would have been okay. It seems stupid. It seems appalling. But it would have been legal because that is part of the duty to rescue. Well, this was in California where, you know, they're a little more flexible about things. And they went ahead and held the bar owner liable, which doesn't bother me much. The guy who wouldn't let him use the telephone was held liable in this case. There was some minimal duty not to impede a rescue that someone else is attempting. And so he was liable. But as a general rule, that's an exception. As a general rule, you have no duty to act. Okay, mental suffering is another one that comes up. Do you have a duty to prevent mental suffering? I've already explained you have no duty to not break hearts. But what about other forms of mental suffering? Well, the law is a little uncomfortable about cases for mental suffering. Seems a little hard to prove, too easy to allege, that sort of thing. So we generally don't let people bring cases for negligent mental suffering. There are some exceptions, though. If I cause you physical harm or physical contact, then that may thereby create a claim for also your mental suffering in addition to your physical harm. Well, you all have heard of the concept of pain and suffering, right? If I cause you an auto accident, you have a lot of direct out-of-pocket monetary damages. You have all your health care costs, which may be out-of-pocket damages, and I have to pay for those. I may also have to pay for your pain and suffering. It's obviously a certain amount of pain and suffering that goes along with having your leg broken or having something else bad happen to you, going into the hospital. That is, of course, mental pain and suffering, but you can recover for that because I caused you physical harm. If I had just caused you mental pain and suffering, maybe by being really rude to you, without any physical harm, you probably can't sue me. I probably haven't breached a duty then. Okay? Next point I have to talk about is, what if there's a contract? What if I have a contract with you? Can you sue me for negligence, or do you have to sue me for breach of contract? Could you sue me for negligently breaching the contract? Well, the general rule is, if we have a contract, we want the contract to settle the issue. So you generally can't sue me for negligently breaching the contract. You have to sue me in contract for that. If we have a contract, you can sue me in tort if some contract-related activity produces personal harm. Thus, if I sell you a car and that car is terribly defective, you couldn't sue me for breach of contract, probably breach of warranty. But you could also sue me in tort because you suffered physical harm. But if you just suffered ordinary economic damages, you can't sue me for negligence in that way. Now, you might think that the reasonable person who's a party to a contract he'd perform the contract, right? He obeys the law, you got to perform contracts. Well, you could say that, but that's not the way the law does it. If you got a contract, the law says you have to sue in contract, not for negligent breach of contract. Okay, and at this point, I want to talk about one more legal rule, which has been fun and controversial, and involves breach of duty somewhat. We haven't talked too much about procedure in the course of my lectures, and we won't, but one thing you have to bear in mind is who has the burden of proof. And as a general rule, in all claims, and in tort claims specifically, the plaintiff, the one doing the suing, has the burden of proof. Sometimes, which means the plaintiff has to prove that the defendant was negligent. Sometimes it may be pretty tough for the plaintiff to prove that the defendant was negligent. The classic example is where a fellow is walking along the street, minding his or her own business, and a large barrel full of something, flies out of a fourth-story window and lands on him and smushes him. Well, he suffered an injury, and he thinks he should get to sue those people up on the fourth floor the barrel came out and hit him, right? But if you think about it, he may have a tough time. He obviously should recover, you think. But he could have a tough time, because he would have to prove that barrel flew out of the window because of negligence, and he has no idea what was going on up there on the fourth floor. He is going to have a tough time presenting proof that they did something negligent or intentional that caused that barrel to fly out the window. So that mean he's lost? No, it doesn't. Because the law developed a doctrine called res ipsa loquitur. That is Latin. The law likes to throw these things in Latin because that enables lawyers to impress you better and enables you to think you need a lawyer because you don't know what res ipsa loquitur means. Res ipsa loquitur is roughly translated as the thing speaks for itself. And what this is a legal doctrine where the guy who was smushed by the barrel can say, well, I was injured by an accident that doesn't ordinarily happen without there being some negligence or intent. Barrels do not leap out of windows of their own volition. If a barrel flies out of a window, that sort of makes you think it must have been due to at least negligence by the part of the people up there. And when that sort of accident occurs, that generally only occurs because of the negligence of someone, and when the available evidence is in the hands of the defendant, that is, the plaintiff doesn't have access to the evidence that would prove negligence, then the plaintiff gets the benefit of res ipsa loquitur and gets the presumption that this must have occurred because of negligence, and now the burden is on the defendant, who has the evidence in its possession anyway, to try and prove that it was not negligent, that in fact this barrel came to life on the X-Files or something and leapt out of the window of its own volition. Okay? Now, there are lots of great res ipsa loquitur cases. One I just heard was where some people were dining in a restaurant and a cow fell through the ceiling and landed on them and their table. Now, I have no idea what the cow was doing on the second story of the restaurant. And neither did the people who were hit. And nor could they prove it. And it was hard for them to prove that it was either negligence to have a cow up there or to have the fall through. But the court said that this is not the sort of thing that ordinarily happens, right? You've dined in restaurants. Have you ever had a cow land on your table? I suspect not. So this is not the sort of thing that ordinarily happens in a non-negligent world. So the fact that it happens is some presumptive prima facie proof of negligence. And now the burden shifts to the restaurant to prove that somehow that they were not negligent. Otherwise, they'll be liable. Okay, I want to talk about some cases here on the general duties part. And negligence is important enough. We're going to put a lot of it off till the next lecture. But let's summarize this level now with some cases. And to understand what some of these torts are, because we haven't talked too much about our intentional torts. What if you're a joker and someone's sitting down at the table and you pull a chair out from them and they fall down and hurt themselves? Have you committed a tort against them? What kind of a tort do you think it is? That would be the tort of battery. While battery ordinarily involves you actually physically hitting, contacting a person, you don't have to do it with your flesh. If you cause a person to be hit, that is good enough. Likewise, this is a fun game. What if you're on an escalator, as crowded escalator? You're about to get on a crowded escalator, you know, people jammed in on a crowded escalator, and you decide to play dominoes with them, right? You give the person at the top of the escalator a big shove. Don't try this at home. That person hits the next person, hits the next person, hits the next person, hits the next person, and the, you know, force goes all the way down the escalator as in dominoes, and they all end up at a heap at the bottom. The person on the bottom step wants to recover for the damages that she suffered as a consequence of all of this. Well, who does she sue and from whom can she recover? Now, she was actually struck by the person on the second from the bottom step. Did that person commit a tort against her? Is she liable? No. That person did nothing intentional or negligent. That person was just in the way of the path of the dominoes. Everybody on the escalator, including the person on the bottom step, gets to sue you, who stood up at the top of the escalator and did this whole thing for fun, set this whole thing in motion for fun. Okay, that's another battery. Now, any unwanted contact can be a battery. It doesn't have to be, you know, physically harmful. Can a kiss be a battery? Could a kiss be a battery, even if, you know, it's not a really violent one? Sure, a kiss can be a battery. An unwanted kiss is unwanted physical contact, and that is a battery. Which, I think, if a lawyer went back and rewrote fairy tales, they could come out far more interesting and different. Sleeping Beauty, after all, was subjected to an intentional tort by Prince Charming, right? She was lying there peacefully asleep, and he kissed her without any permission on her part. I think that's a battery. She could have sued him. Perhaps she should have sued him. I don't know. Who knows what nice dream she was having? Well, okay. Enough of that. Okay, here's another intentional one to throw in before we do some negligent ones. This was a case where a golfer became quite annoyed that his caddy, the caddy was not paying attention. Why? Bill Murray or something. So the golfer swung his golf club at the caddy. Now, he didn't want to hit his caddy. He wasn't even close enough to hit his caddy. He just wanted to get the caddy's attention. You know, bring the caddy to life. You know, pay attention. So he swings the club. And it happens that the head on his golf club was faulty. And when he swung the club, the head of the golf club flew off and hit the caddy in the head, hit the caddy in the eye, and caused some significant harm. Is that golfer liable to the caddy, do you think? It's not an easy... I mean, I think you could argue that the golfer was liable in negligence, that it's negligent to swing a golf club at someone even if you don't expect to hit him, because all sorts of things could have happened. I mean, the club could have slipped out of his hands or something like that. But the court actually held that the golfer had committed an assault, you know, meant to instill fear in the caddy, and that the head flying off was a consequence of that assault. And so he's liable for that, too. You might say, well, no, he shouldn't be liable for that. He had no idea that could happen. But this is not uncommon in an assault. If I point a gun at you, and you're so scared, you turn around and run right into a door. I mean, my assault caused that, so I'm liable for that. Okay, let's think about some negligence cases. Here's a good one. There was a cab driver. Cab drivers sometimes have a rough life. They have to deal with criminals. A cab driver got in his cab. A guy jumps in the cab, points a gun at the cab driver, and says, "Step on it." The cab driver, there's a bit of a commotion. What the cab driver does is he, at one point, jams on the emergency brake, though he leaves the motor running, and jumps out of the cab. You know, he's quick. He's Michael Jordan-like, almost, in doing this, I guess. But he opens the door, pulls on the emergency brake, and jumps out of the cab to avoid the risk of being shot. You know, not a bad self-rescue there. Except it happens that the emergency brake on this cab, I guess, didn't work perfectly. The cab kept rolling along, and some innocent third party was standing there in the road, and the cab hit him. Pedestrian accident. So, the innocent third party wants to recover. Should they be able to recover from... Well, who would you sue if you were the innocent third party? Well, you could sue the criminal, of course, because the criminal set this whole thing in motion. But one unfortunate thing is that these people who commit these crimes and cause all sorts of damage usually don't have enough money to pay the damages. It doesn't do you much good to get a $1 million verdict against a pauper. So they don't just sue the... I don't know if they sued the criminal. They sued the cabbie and the cab company, derivatively. Should the cabbie be liable here in this case, do you think? It's not an easy question, I don't think. You could say that it was negligent. I mean, it was smart of him to jump out of the cab, but it was negligent. But the court said, no, this was an emergency situation. While ordinarily a reasonable person would not jump out of the car with the motor running, because of the facts of this situation, the cab driver acted as a reasonable person, and the injured pedestrian, who's just tough luck, I guess, could not recover for negligence on the part of the cab driver. Okay, here's sort of a modern-day example. Dungeons and Dragons. You've heard of this game, perhaps. I don't know if you have. It's a game where you act out these roles, and it's all very sort of medieval. You're fighting with dragons, and you're fighting with evil forces, and you're supposed to save the queen or something. I don't know. I haven't played it. And kids, and even semi-grown-ups, you know, college-age people, get very caught up in this. There are various campuses around the country where people are acting out Dungeons and Dragons, running around in steam tunnels under the campus. Not very safe. But they get very caught up in it. Well, there was one case where a parent got the Dungeons and Dragons game for her son, and he became very interested in it. She thought he was maybe a little obsessed in it. And unfortunately, he sometime later committed suicide. She sued the mother, sued the manufacturers of Dungeons and Dragons, saying this was negligence. They're letting this very dangerous game out on the market, and they had no warning. They had no warning that it, you know, might cause your son to lose his mind, become obsessed, whatever. So the manufacturers of Dungeons & Dragons were sued. Do you think they should be liable? A court said no. A court said, and it said no for a variety of reasons. But one reason it said no was there was no evidence of a breach of duty here. Dungeons & Dragons had no reason to believe that they would cause this sort of harm. By my understanding, there's not even a suicide option in Dungeons & Dragons. The heroes of Dungeons & Dragons don't commit suicide. They're supposed to go out and save people. So there's no reason to think that the game would cause someone to commit suicide. I mean, if the guy had gone out and killed someone's large pet lizard, okay, maybe that would be produced by Dungeons & Dragons, but not a suicide. So it just wasn't a foreseeable, it wasn't part of the reasonable duty of the company to expect this sort of thing and respond to it. Okay, one more question, not an answer, to leave you with. We've talked about the reasonable person standard. Well, for many years it was the reasonable man standard. We became a little less sexist. Women commit torts too, so it became the reasonable person standard. But now the question is, maybe we should have two different standards. One, a reasonable man standard, and one, reasonable woman standard. Should we have different tests? You know, we make different circumstances based upon age, right? We have different we take that into account based upon differential age of the defendant. So perhaps we should make a difference based on the gender of the defendant. Well, a lot of people are going to balk at this. They're going to say that, you know, when it comes to driving a car, there should be no difference. But maybe sometimes there should. In sexual harassment cases, which are very common, the courts have recognized this problem. And the courts have said that a reasonable woman may react differently to a certain sort of harassing action than would a reasonable man. That hasn't been imported very much into general tort or negligence law, but maybe it should. It's just something for you to think about. That's enough for today. Thanks.